Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Studio O, just north of Philadelphia, in the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. In tonight's episode, episode 55, we are asking Svalbard. We call it asking Svalbard because we're employing the seven-unit structure of my Intro to Human Geography course to frame a set of questions about a specific place. It's not 20 questions per se, but not too far off. Joining us from Svalbard is Rolf Stange, who has spent the last 20 plus years living between Dresden, where he's from, and Longyearbyen, Svalbard, where he works as a guide, where he has traveled quite extensively, and where he spends most months of the year these days. A physical geographer by training, Rolf offers us, outsiders for sure, an inside look at the culture, political structure, food system, and economy of the archipelago of Svalbard. I found Rolf through his top-selling guidebook, Spitsbergen Svalbard, a complete guide around the Arctic archipelago. He joins us from his home in Longyearbyen. Let's jump into Unit 1, which this unit that we talk about is really about the nature of geography, what is geography, and the perspectives of geography. And within that, we do talk a little bit about mapping. And so, in cartography, the Arctic is always on a flat, two-dimensional map, is usually sort of exaggerated in ways that maybe shape the way we think about the Arctic, seeing Greenland so big, for instance. And I think we lose a sense of where we're looking at. So let's start. We're talking about Svalbard. Where is Svalbard located? I think a lot of times we should start there.
Well, yes, Svalbard's very far north, 78 degrees. It's going straight through the main island, so this means it's halfway between northernmost Norway, the famous North Cape, and the North Pole itself. And, well, if you really want to know what the Earth looks like, of course, you have to take a globe and not just a map to get a three-dimensional picture. And if you take a globe, then you will see that Svalbard is just under the North Pole. It's about 1,000 kilometers from the north coast of the main island to the North Pole, or maybe 1,100 kilometers.
And so from that same point to the Arctic Circle, how many kilometers do you think?
Well, the Arctic Circle, which is 66 degrees, 33 minutes north, and if you take it to 78 degrees, which is roughly where Longyearbyen is, the main settlement, that makes it around about, what are we looking at, 12 degrees of latitude, so it's 1,300, 1,400 kilometers.
All right, so it's closer to the North Pole than it is to the Arctic Circle.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Good.
It's not the northernmost land in the world. There's North Greenland going further north. There is Franz Josef Land in the Russian Arctic, but it's pretty far.
And then Longyearbyen, you mentioned, is that the largest town of it? Is it the largest town that far north, or is it the northernmost town of its size?
It is absolutely the northernmost town of its size. It's the main town of Svalbard, the main settlement. There are other places further north, like New Ålesund, which is also here in Spitsbergen, which is just under 79 degrees. But it's not really a settlement. It's not a place where families are living. And there are fewer people anyway. It's between 100 and 200, whereas Longyearbyen has about 2,500. And it's easily accessible for everybody. And, well, families living here, there's a school, a hospital, and things like that, public infrastructure. And New Ålesund doesn't have anything of that.
Yeah.
There are weather stations and military bases in both Arctic Russia and Arctic Canada and northernmost Greenland. But there's nothing you could call settlements. These are stations.
Right. Now, another part of this unit, we talk about place names or toponyms. I hear a difference between Svalbard and Spitsbergen. What's the difference for you?
Yeah, the difference for me, well, there is a historical perspective.
Yeah.
The Spitsbergen, which means pointed mountains, was attached to the main island in 1596 when it was discovered by a Dutch seafarer, Willem Barents. And so it has been on the map since then. And the term Svalbard is a bit more obscure. It was mentioned in an Icelandic chronicle in 1194, I think it was. But the reference is a bit unclear. It could be, it means cold rim or cold edge. So it might as well have been East Greenland or Jan Mayen, which is another Arctic island, or the pack ice edge. Could in theory just as well have been, well, Spitsbergen or Svalbard, no?
Uh-huh.
But it's a different and more unclear historical reference.
Yeah.
And regarding the place names as they are used today, which I think makes a lot of sense to have two different terms, one for the main island and one for the whole archipelago, which is a number of islands. And the official use today is Svalbard for the whole archipelago and Spitsbergen for the main island.
Yeah.
And that makes sense.
It does. Do you see there's a... In the German-speaking world, is the preference Spitsbergen for the whole? And
well, it is. It is, especially in the Dutch-speaking world,
Dutch
have a historical connection to it, and now some people can get quite emotional about it.
Yeah.
Or passionate. But yes, there are definitely people who will prefer Spitsbergen, and others who will prefer Svalbard, depending on their perspective on the history.
Yeah. Now, Longyearbyen, the largest town, or I guess we could call it an urban area, where does it get its name from?
Sorry, where does it get what from?
Where does it get its name from, Longyearbyen?
Longyearbyen, yes, there is an easy explanation to that. Longyearbyen was founded in 1906 by John Munro Longyear, an American who founded a coal mine here. And it was originally called Longyear City, and then later it was just translated into Norwegian. Byen means the city,
uh-huh.
So Longyearbyen is the Longyear City.
Let's move into to Unit 2, and I think that's a good segue, talking about Longyearbyen. Population and migration is our Unit 2. And who lives in Svalbard? I guess I'll throw out all the questions here. Who lives in Svalbard? Where are they from? And what brought them there?
Oh, yeah, that's, of course, a big question. there's a whole lot of different people living here.
Yeah.
And especially, as you say, Svalbard as a whole, you've got Russian settlements also, which is a whole different topic. So if we just have a look at Longyearbyen to begin with, that's complex enough. There's about 2,500 people. Well, in the past, into the 70s and early 80s, maybe, it was a company town. It was coal mining and nothing else.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't live here if you didn't have a job with a coal mining company, and maybe and a few trappers and hunters, but there weren't many of them anymore in the 70s. Just a very few. So until then, it was company town, coal mining exclusively. And since the 80s, it has opened up to become a kind of a normal settlement, which it isn't really, of course, considering the location. But by now, it's essentially free for everybody to live here who wants to, as long as you can support yourself. That's a very complex thing that has to do with the Spitsbergen Treaty. I guess we might come to that a bit later.
Yeah.
But today there are families here. People have ordinary jobs as you have elsewhere in Western countries. They are teachers, they are scientists, of course. They're still working in coal mining, which is still active here, although not on a very big scale. And they have their families here with their children in school. So Longyearbyen tries more or less successfully to be a normal settlement. That's what it is.
Yeah.
And it is very international. That's important to mention that you are free to live here regardless of your nationality. You don't need a permit to stay, to work, to live here.
You don't?
No, you don't, because it's governed by the Spitsbergen Treaty, which was signed in 1920 and came into force in 1925. Until then, Svalbard was no man's land.
Hmm.
And And all the signatory countries wanted to make sure that they and their citizens still keep the right of access in the same way as Norwegians had it from then on. So it is still open for everybody.
Yeah,
you can just stay here. On the other hand, there is no social security system. If you cannot support yourself anymore, if you don't have a job or a full bank account, then you just have to leave.
You have to leave, yeah. I came across the school website, and it allowed you to translate the school website from Norwegian into, I think, three or four other languages, Russian, English, but then also Thai. What's the connection to Thailand?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. There is no connection to Thailand as such, just that Thai people have discovered this opportunity to live here in a kind of a part of Europe, in a Western country, in a wealthy country such as Norway, without having to ask for a working permission or permission to stay, anything like that. They can just come and stay legally.
Yeah,
they find jobs and make good money. So this is what happened some time ago. There was just a person who came for personal reasons and started the whole thing. And she was a clever businesswoman, started up a small business and in like housekeeping and cleaning, and quickly asked friends to come up, become employees, and then more people followed.
So,
this is just what happened.
A chain migration, as we call it, I guess.
Exactly, yes. Mm.
Yeah.
Could have been any other country, just happened to be Thailand in this case.
Just happened to be Thailand, yeah.
Yeah.
So you said 2,500, more or less, is that year-round? Or I'm sure it swells the population in the summertime, right?
Yes, but this the permanent population, like summer employees, there's a number of them, especially within tourism.
Yeah.
But they are not counted as part of the population. You can become a resident if you stay at least a half a year or more than that.
Okay.
But so that's the permanent population, yes, that's year-round.
That's the year-round population. So let's move into Unit 3, cultural patterns and processes. And this is something maybe that's come out of my discussions in the classroom a little bit in looking about the friction between globalized culture and local culture. In what ways might you say Svalbard is connected to globalized culture, and especially with the 20 plus years of working there? I'm sure that's changed. I'm sure, or at least that's my hypothesis here, that becoming more connected to globalized culture, whether that's through more access to TV or things like that, that you've seen a change in the last 20 years. Is that true?
Yes, that's definitely true. And I think that's connected, well, mainly to the opening up of the place from being a coal mining settlement, a company town exclusively, to a place where everybody can live, where you can come and rent or buy a house, which is difficult. It's a very expensive place to live, but at least it is generally possible. And then this aspect of, well, it is free, everybody's free to live here. And that attracted people from a lot of countries. We mentioned the Thai people who are high up on the list after Norwegians and other Scandinavian nationalities. And the Thai people and other people from other countries in Europe, like English, French, Germans. And then, of course, there's all sorts of other countries, United States, Canada, and so on and so forth. So it is a very international place, and it is also a very modern place. There's a very fast internet connection. There are satellite stations here, so they needed a very fast connection from Longyearbyen to the mainland. So there's a glass fiber cable providing that. And this means that Longyearbyen is well connected to technology. And there's a university with an international science and scientists and students. And that altogether makes it a very modern and very international place.
Yeah. I mean, just to remind our listeners, we are speaking over the internet on Skype. You are in Longyearbyen right now, and I'm in Pennsylvania in the United States. So this connection is just as good as any connection I've had in Western Europe or elsewhere. Yeah, it's working really nice. How about you walk down the street of Longyearbyen? I mean, in terms of the built environment, reading that cultural landscape, are you seeing, now you mentioned the Thai workers maybe, or people going there from Thailand, maybe working in more service kind of jobs. Do you see any evidence of Thailand in the landscape? Or is there a restaurant? Is there a Thai restaurant now that kind of communicates this globalization? Is there signage in English? Is really just in Norwegian?
Well, the Thai presence isn't very obvious as you just walk through Longyearbyen.
Yeah.
There was a Thai restaurant, but unfortunately they closed a year ago or so.
Uh-huh.
There is a Thai shop, so you can buy Thai food and other stuff. But other than that, it's not very visible. But English signs and everything is mainly, as far as tourists are concerned, there is a lot of tourism here.
Yeah.
And it's very international, especially in the summer season, the ship-based tourism. But still, Norwegian is the main language and the official language. So all road signs and written communication is mainly in Norwegian.
Yeah. And you've learned Norwegian over the years, I'm sure.
Yes, that's very useful. It's not strictly necessary to be in Longyearbyen, but it's certainly useful to make things happen and to get in touch.
Yeah. And so would you say that Norwegian's the dominant language, or is English, like it does in other places, sort of slowly creep in and become or at least it's a lingua franca, I suppose?
Yeah, it certainly is. Depends a bit on which environment you're in here.
Yeah.
In the university, for example, is English-speaking. The education and university, and it's 50% international students. And in other parts of the society, say coal mining and the local industry, the school and everything, that's Norwegian. And they want to keep it that way. And it is a bit difficult because there are a lot of people from various countries, including families with children, but they don't even offer Norwegian courses. So it is a bit challenging in real life.
Yeah.
But they want Norwegian to be the main the main language. And it certainly is the official language as well.
Yeah. So there is sort of this tension between here's one of those global processes, the domination of English as a lingua franca, maybe challenging the place of Norwegian there. But people are kind of holding strong and saying we should maintain that.
Yes, and there is space for both, and I think people are aware of that. There are certainly places where it's appropriate to speak English, such as the university and large parts of tourism, and other places like in the school and in many homes here where Norwegian is the main language.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring academic and everyday geographical thinking together. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions, like how does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program or radio essay expedition that's broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrik in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. Now let's get back to our episode. Unit 4 is about, and you've already, I think, gotten into this a little bit, but maybe we could review that. The, Unit 4 is about the political organization of space. So Svalbard is currently, would you say they're governed by Norway? They're a territory of Norway? How does that work?
Well, I think it would be proper to say that it's governed by Norway. Spitsbergen, the term Svalbard wasn't in use in the early 20s okay. or the 19th century. It was hardly used by anyone back then. And so in 1920, there was a treaty signed because it became clear when mining started in the early 20th century that someone had to govern this place. There had to be laws and police enforcing the laws and everything.
Yeah.
And a proper structure. So in 1920, a treaty was signed in Paris to give Norway sovereignty. One of the reasons was it was one of the nearest neighbors, and they were interested, and the other bigger powers didn't really have any interest. So they gave Norway the sovereignty over the Spitsbergen Archipelago, as it is called in the treaty. Mm-hmm. The term Svalbard isn't used, as I said.
Right.
But at the same time, they made sure that they would keep access both, mainly for their citizens and companies. Like there were Swedish and Dutch companies, for example, and English and Scottish, other nationalities. Americans had already pulled out, and Longyearbyen was already Norwegian back then, in 1920. But there were a lot of companies from different countries, and they wanted to make sure that they wouldn't have any difficulties keeping their business here active. So there's this right of free access for everybody. So Norway does not have full sovereignty over Spitsbergen as they have on the mainland. They cannot just tell people to move away work permits or so on. You don't need that.
Right.
But it is definitely under Norwegian sovereignty. Norwegian law is valid also in the Russian settlements, by the way. So it is certainly Norwegian by all means, yes.
Oh, so even in the Russian settlements, the Norwegian law is what's followed.
Yes, this is correct. There were up to four Russian settlements in Spitsbergen in the 20th century, all of them in the biggest fjord, East Fjord, so all of them within 50 kilometers from Longyearbyen, and so neighbors in a way.
Yeah.
But it was all on Norwegian territory under Norwegian law, even though it was certainly difficult to enforce that during the Cold War years. Hmm. So that was something that mainly happened after 1990, that the Russian settlements accepted Norwegian sovereignty in real life also. But these places have always been Russian private property in an area governed by Norwegian law. They have never been Russian territory.
You're right. But in practice, maybe there was some tension between these Russian settlements and the greater Norwegian community?
Yes, there has definitely been. Well, at times, actually, the Russian community was the bigger one. There were like mid 20th century or into the 70s, 80s. There were more Russians living in their settlements than Norwegians in Longyearbyen and the other Norwegian settlements. So there was a Russian majority, actually.
Yeah.
But they were very powerful. They didn't, in their settlements, of course, the Norwegian police had difficulties to find out if there was a case or to enforce their law. So practical sovereignty was difficult for the Norwegians in the Russian settlements.
Yeah.
But by now, the Russian settlements are smaller now. Three out of four have been abandoned, largely at least, and there's only one active with not 1,000 people anymore. Now it's between 400 and 500. And the Norwegian governor and police have a presence there as much as they want at any time.
Yeah. I mean, during the Cold War, was there like a geopolitical strategic rationale for being present and building those communities in Spitsbergen or Svalbard?
Certainly was. Well, maybe first of all, I should say that according to the treaty, the 1920 treaty, Spitsbergen is a demilitarized zone. In that sense that it's not allowed to establish any permanent military facilities here. And Norwegians, for example, have Coast Guard ships here quite regularly, which is part of the military, but no naval bases or anything like that. But of course, it makes sense if you think that it might be useful in any upcoming military situation to have some kind of infrastructure that might be used for that purpose. Then it makes sense to have a settlement. And for example, the Russian settlements, the main settlement, Barentsburg, used to have a pretty big helicopter base with 5 large helicopters, and the base is still there. Now it's down to 1 helicopter. But this means that with their 5 helicopters and a number of miners, they would have been able to take control of the airport near Longyearbyen in no time, essentially. Which, of course, it was not officially military. That wouldn't have been allowed. But in practice, it is safe to assume that the miners would have been able to do that, and they would have had enough trained personnel for any kind of local operation here.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, let's shift to the local government. Is there a strong local government, or are people sort of looking down south for approval for making decisions, or is it really a stronger regional or local government making decisions on the archipelago?
It is a bit of both.
Yeah.
On one side, in Longyearbyen, you've got a community which is elected locally, so there is local democracy in Longyearbyen, and they make their local decisions just as any community does. For everything on a governmental level, there is a governor who is called the Sysselmannen by the Norwegians, and he or she is the highest representative here of the Norwegian government, and certainly involved when it comes to lawmaking decisions in Oslo.
Uh-huh.
And the governor as an institution has police force and things like that. So there are both levels are present, and both levels are important.
Yeah. Do you see any local decisions or any local discussions, and I mean in a public forum here, not just everyday citizens having those discussions, but the public government apparatus talking a little bit about the what ifs of climate change, or even the what's already being experienced, like any sort of laws that might be changed, or talk about building up the infrastructure along the seacoast. Are any of those things being discussed already?
Oh yes, absolutely. That receives great public attention here in Longyearbyen.
Yeah.
In recent years, from 2015, there has that's probably the main thing. There have been a couple of avalanches, destroying houses, and unfortunately, people also got killed. There were 2 victims in the first of these recent avalanches when their houses were destroyed. Well, 11 houses destroyed on that occasion.
Yeah.
And that is something that is not, of course, just linked to climate change. That could have happened 50 years ago as well. But of course, the frequency and the impact of such events is that there will be more of them. And that's something that keeps people busy here.
Yeah.
Because now it is studied that and found out that houses in certain locations are at risk and have to be secured, which is happening, or others even have to be removed, which is also happening now soon. And so other places need to be built to provide accommodation. And
that's being mandated by the local government.
Yes, that's mainly the local government which is responsible for that. But of course, they seek for advice and funding from the mainland, institutions and government as well. That would be too much for a small community to deal with that without any outside support.
Right, right. Talking about local regulations, can you walk out of Longyearbyen without a gun? Is that a relatively recent regulation?
There's a clear yes and no to that. Well, to start with, there's no law that actually requires to carry a weapon when you walk out of Longyearbyen or any other settlement for that sake. Having said that, it would be very unwise to do so, and I don't know any locals here who would go for a walk, even in the near neighborhood of Longyearbyen, without carrying a rifle or another suitable weapon. Huh. Of course, polar bears, well, they can be seen close to Longyearbyen year-round. There was one here, and we could even see it from our home, just a few hundred meters away from houses where people live. Yeah. The police scared it away with a helicopter in the end. So, but yes, you have to be prepared, and it would be very unwise to just to go for a walk without suitable protection, which in practice means a weapon for most people. Yeah, you would just put yourself at great risk.
So let's move to Unit 5 here, which is our agriculture and food production unit. I think one of the questions that's come up in discussions from here in Pennsylvania is, well, how does the food system work? Where do people get their food from? How much is local? How much is brought in from the mainland or from the south? What's your sense on that?
Well, it's a very simple answer to that is pretty much everything is imported.
Yeah.
There is almost no agriculture here, and hunting and fishing don't really play a role. That's something some people are doing their free time, but there is not really a fishing industry here, and there is no fishing harbor, so even fish is imported from mainland Norway, uh-huh. even if it may have been caught in the vicinity here. Huh. Hunting is also just playing a role on an individual level, and everything is imported, so you will find the same range of products that you will find in any supermarket on mainland Norway.
Yeah.
Well, maybe a bit less smaller range, and especially regarding fresh products. There is, and I would quite like to mention that one guy in Longyearbyen, however, Benjamin Wittmar, who is trying to establish local agriculture, he's got something that's similar to a greenhouse. It's something different, though.
Uh-huh.
So he's trying to grow vegetables locally without using great resources and water, energy, and light, trying to establish a sustainable system.
Yeah.
But if that is to support the local population here on any significant level, then there's certainly still a long way to go.
Yeah. He was highlighted on BBC, a short video about his project there. And we looked at it in the classroom a little bit and wondered, yeah, to what extent could those greenhouses impact the local food sourcing? Who's using the food that he's producing? Is it the local restaurants mostly, or?
Yes, it's local restaurants, and you can buy some stuff in the supermarket.
Uh-huh.
But seeing that as part of a total picture, the volume is irrelevant. It is a great perspective. It's a great effort.
Yeah.
And of course, we can just hope that it is taken up to a higher, industrial level, if you want
yeah.
so.
Right.
But at the moment, if you stop that now and today, it wouldn't change the choice that you have in the supermarket at all, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about 2,500 people living there. This is a small production to maybe show what's possible. So maybe there's a future to continue to develop this?
Yeah, that's of course the idea, and there's many people here who would support that, and I'm not sure exactly about Benjamin's plans, but of course he would need support from a major player who has got the power and the financials to take it further, really.
Yeah.
But technically, I think it would certainly be possible to take it up to a higher level.
Yeah, to go back to the sort of government stuff. Is the local government behind it? Is there or the Norwegian government? Are there grants that he could be applying for, or others that are interested in continuing that work and expanding the impact here? Is the government supporting that?
Well, that's obviously a question that Ben should answer. I don't see. Well, looking at the public discussion, I don't really see that there's a lot of public support for this project from official side, from any official side, like the local government or the even the national governments, I don't think there's a lot of interest really from a public side.
Yeah. Let me ask, so the household level for you, do you spend more on food there than you do back in Germany?
Absolutely, yes. Food is expensive here.
Yeah.
I mean, it is generally more expensive in Norway than it would be in pretty much any other country in Europe. And it's up to 2 or 3 times, so it's not just like 10 or 20% more expensive. It's the twice as much or even 3 times as expensive as it would be in Germany.
Wow.
Spitsbergen is a low-tax area, but transportation is expensive, and of course many shops have kind of, they're monopolists here, there's not much of a choice, not much competition, that may also be a factor. But so it is generally in a very expensive place, including stuff you need every day, food and so on.
Right. Does that encourage people to go hunting, those who do hunt? I mean, to save money, and so you're getting your protein source from... what are the major animals you would hunt? What are the big animals that would be hunted? Reindeer?
Well, the biggest, yes. Reindeer is the one, the biggest one that people hunt here.
Yeah.
Reindeer is quite limited. And all animals that are even bigger, like polar bears and walruses, they are all completely protected here.
Right.
So reindeer, ptarmigan, some other birds, seals. So there are some people who do that. But actually, I think in the long term, most people will spend more money going hunting than they would spend buying their food in the supermarket. So I don't think it's an economical decision. It's rather... an inclination, that's something that people have passion for, and they like to go out into nature and they like going hunting.
Right.
I don't think it's an economical thing.
Because the amount of money you have to put in to just make a trip out to go find the animals you want to hunt is quite expensive.
Exactly, yes. It takes a lot of time if you go hunting. You will have to use a boat, which you have to have in the first place, and fuel and all the other equipment. So I think financially you're certainly better off if you spend the day doing some paid work and go to the supermarket then.
Yeah. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. In terms of like economic development, I think you've alluded to or discussed a little bit earlier, the growth of the town through mining, but it's really transitioned though, hasn't it, from the primary sort of economic sector of mining and resource extraction to now maybe a third sector, tourism industry that's really quite strong. You've probably seen in the 20 plus years the boom of the tourism industry. How has this happened?
Well, first of all, there's a need for Longyearbyen to get away from mining. Which is simply not the future anymore, although it is still going on. So there are still mine workers and a little bit of industry around that. But then there's a whole scene of, well, this is science, the university and research institutions. And, of course, tourism. On one side, there is simply a demand. There's a lot of people who want to see the Arctic. And Spitsbergen is, it is one of the most beautiful parts of the Arctic. And it is accessible in contrast to other parts of the Arctic, in the Russian Arctic, in northernmost Greenland, Canada.
Uh-huh.
Well, you've also got beautiful and fascinating areas, but they're very hard to get to, whereas there are scheduled flights to Longyearbyen year-round almost on a daily basis.
Yeah.
So and that, of course, creates a demand. And in principle, the Norwegian government is open for tourism here because they just see the need. They want to sustain Longyearbyen as much as possible as a normal Norwegian settlement. So there need to be jobs. There need to be some kind of economy, and tourism is one of the obvious possibilities.
Yeah, I mean, if we were to measure the growth of tourism there by when the flights started to go daily instead of maybe less than frequent. I'm sure at some point it was weekly, but. When did you notice like a real shift to wait, I can get a commercial flight almost every day? Is that just the last 10 years or since the 1990s? What's your feel on this?
Yeah, I think that's certainly since the 90s. I mean, now there are sometimes two or three flights a day.
Oh, right.
And back then was maybe one, a day or two in the week without any flights. So it has certainly, I can only guess right now, but... It's certainly two or three times more flights than there were 20 years ago. But even then, there were five, six, seven flights a week from mainland Norway up to Longyearbyen. Yeah. So, but this airport was built opened in, was it 77 or so, in the mid-70s anyway. Mm-hmm. So back then, there was already a demand and they started flying several times a week. So it's not that flights have exploded like in the last... just 20 years or so. That's a development that started in the 70s, mainly out of the demand of the coal mining and activities around that.
Yeah.
I could say a few more words about the tourism situation because that's quite divided into different sectors. There's the summer tourism here, like the ships going around Spitsbergen and doing trips on a couple of days up to 2 weeks or even more in some cases, and that's very international.
Yeah.
That's mainly from June into August or even into September. And then there's winter tourism, that's high season from, say, late February into early May. Mm-hmm. And that's more Norwegian or Scandinavian. Of course, there's also international tourists then. But two operators active in that part, in the winter tourism, which is mainly snowmobiles, but also dog sledging, skiing, and other activities.
Yeah.
That's mainly in Longyearbyen. So that's the mainly the tourism that Norwegian government would really want to support. But summer tourism is more international and people flying in from all over the world.
Okay, right. And mostly ship-based or?
Summer tourism is mostly ship-based. Yes, of course, there is hiking. There's great hiking opportunities.
Uh-huh.
But most international tourists would go on a boat for just a few days or a bit more, or stay in Longyearbyen and go on shorter hikes, some other activities, boat-based day trips to the Russian settlements, for example, other excursions. But in the summer, it's really mainly ship-based.
Yeah, and the people that work on those ships, how many are locals to Longyearbyen? Probably very few, right?
Yes, the summer tourism isn't really that important for local employment here because the large majority of people working on these ships, they will be international, like the crews of the ships. No cruise ship has its home port here in Longyearbyen.
Yeah.
So they have their crews on board wherever they may come from. And then, of course, there's the hotel staff, the guides, the expedition staff. They will also usually be international people, or even within the Norwegian companies. There is the Hurtigruten, which is quite famous, the formal postal steamers. They're quite big and active, and even on their ships, they've partly got international guides and Norwegian ones, some of them may live here in Longyearbyen and others may come from the mainland.
Yeah. So the locals benefit more from the winter tourism, it sounds like then.
Yes, that's definitely the case. The winter tourists, they stay in Longyearbyen. So they pay for accommodation, which creates jobs again. They go to the restaurants
Yeah.
They do day trips which are run by local companies and usually involve either local guides or guides who live for the season at least.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas summer tourism often involves large numbers of tourists to just take a bus from the airport to go to a ship and then off they are. They are not seen in Longyearbyen or just come for a few hours. And bigger cruise ships who visit Longyearbyen may put 2,000 people ashore, but only for a couple of hours. So they do a bit of shopping and do some excursions that brings money to a limited number of companies.
Right.
But the society as a whole doesn't really benefit from that.
No. What's your feel, the percentage of people working in tourism out of that 2,500 or 2,500 population? Are you talking 1,000 people are working in somehow related to tourism or not that much?
No, it won't be that many. Well, first of all, if it's 2,500 people, that includes families, and not all of them are working, of course, children, and it also includes part of the research community, at least as much as they are staying for more than half a year.
Yeah.
So most students will not be part of the statistics, but it's hard to tell, but it will be less than 1,000 people. If you have like 2,000 people working in Longyearbyen, then maybe just as a rough estimate, it could be 40% or so working in tourism, which is still a lot.
Yeah, definitely. So with this, the size of the town here in Longyearbyen, and this will lead us into our last unit here, which is cities and urban land use. Most people might not think of Longyearbyen as a city, but certainly is an urban area and has urban issues. What are some of the major urban issues in terms of, I don't know, maybe waste removal? How does that work?
Well, waste removal is something that is working well. It is mainly shipped out and taken to the mainland where a lot is recycled, like glass, paper, metal, and so on.
Yeah.
And others is burned. So that is mostly not happening locally. So that is working well. Something that keeps people busy, rather, is the housing situation.
Yeah.
There is the loss of houses due to avalanches and the avalanche risk. And another factor that is often discussed, although it's not really known to what degree is actually impacting the situation, is Airbnb. Some house owners rent their flats up to tourists rather than to people who want to live there on a permanent basis. So it is a huge problem for people who want to live here and find a job, but you don't have a lot of money to begin with to find housing. It's living here. House rents are as high as central Oslo, which is one of the most expensive capitals in Europe.
Yeah.
So it is a very difficult place to find accommodation, really, on a long-term basis. That's one of the main issues, really.
Yeah, and is it because the city council or city government is limiting growth at all? Or are they trying to... I mean, I've looked at pictures. I haven't been to Longyearbyen yet. I'll be there early next week. There's a physical geography that maybe limits growth because there's some peak, some sort of mountainous or hills around the area. Is there a limitation to how far or how much Longyearbyen can grow outwards?
Yes, there is certainly limitation just physically. I mean, in the past, areas were used which were more or less flat, and now in recent years, it's not totally new knowledge, but now it really comes into the process that some of these areas are exposed to avalanche risk and others could be flooded. There are some small rivers in Longyearbyen, and so there are not that many areas which are actually suitable. And wherever possible, houses are being built right now, so there is a lot of construction activity going on. But as a consequence of this avalanche risk thing, about 140 flats will have to be removed, and that's actually now starting very soon. And that may actually be extended to a total of around 180 which is a large number for a settlement of 2,500 people.
Yeah.
And houses are being built elsewhere to replace that, but that just takes more time.
Yeah.
That so there's just shortage of housing and limited space to grow into for the settlement physically.
Do people project the growth of the population in the next 10 years? Is there fear that there just won't be enough housing for the people that want to come in? Are there plans to build higher instead of wider and outside the town? Is that anything that's being discussed publicly?
Well, that you don't have enough housing for the people who want to live here. I mean, that's not just a projection. That's
a current reality
today. But
So
houses are being built, and of course they are built, and in an economical way, in that sense that you can have more more flats. The houses are getting bigger. They're like you have not just flats going over two levels. So the houses are used more economically to create more spaces, but it is not. It doesn't seem like the population as such will explode, as it does in many other cities in the world.
Yeah,
there's not much of a natural population growth here, and yes, there are people who want to live here. But if we could keep the supply stable for a population of 2,500, I think that would make life much easier. But it's not that it has to be 3,000 and 3,500 in 10 years. That's not the scenario.
No. Well, I want to thank you for joining us on the show and going through these sort of seven themes, seven lenses of looking at Svalbard and Spitsbergen. Thanks to Rolf for taking the time from there in Longyearbyen to speak with us.
Thank you. Thank you much for having me on.
So there you have it, episode 55, Asking Svalbard. Taking one place, employing a set of questions to get a better understanding of that place, to move beyond our limited imaginations, our limited mental maps of places far away, of places unknown, of places unknowable. Svalbard, well above the Arctic Circle, closer to the North Pole than to that circle. I'll be going in 3 days from this recording. Can't wait for it. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to Mike Allen for use of his song, Sand Dune. Stay tuned for future episodes exploring more the Arctic in our minds. Talk to you soon. Bye.